It's an overcast day here in California, where the clouds and mist tend to make a walk on the beach feel almost like a fantasy, and in fact, seems to induce in me a state of reverie, where I start to daydream and get lost in thought. I started pondering some of the mystics of the past, who are all but forgotten in our modern age, but whose teachings persist in occult and esoteric circles that still do not subscribe to the mainstream and continue to acknowledge the existence of not only the mind and body, but of the spirit as well. Being an anthropologist, I'm oftentimes shunned by my academic peers because I stubbornly reject their, as of yet, unproven hypothesis for how humanity came to be, which not only subscribes to an overly materialistic, scientifically dubious theory for how and where human life originated and evolved, but rejects the age-old belief in the human soul. Modern mainstream academia is anything but academic, consisting of a hollow shell of what it once was before the brain drain following World War II, where universities have been reduced to nothing more than corporate financed, politically motivated, Marxist indoctrination centers pushing a globalist agenda which seems less concerned with educating the populace and more concerned with socially engineering them. That said, I refuse to bend the knee and instead keep walking forward on the path that the truth takes me, rather than following a road put forth by those that restrict freedom of speech and therefore deny freedom of thought. While many people are indoctrinated into the belief that the good guys won World War II by defeating fascism, which may or may not be the case, the end result, in any event, has been nothing less than a totalitarian fascist society, which ironically seems to lack the slightest clue that it lives under a completely controlled media, a falsified interpretation of history, and a fictitious, manufactured reality that is promoted by celebrities, sellout politicians, movies, and the blatant propaganda that the mainstream media calls news. While we are told that we now stand at the pinnacle of human achievement and progressivism, the truth seems to indicate that we've actually digressed over multiple generations, devolving technologically, culturally, and spiritually towards a transhumanist agenda that promises enhanced longevity and cognition, but in actuality resembles eternal slavery for the human species. When I suggest that we have devolved since World War II, in a technological sense, this means that the dream of free energy was not only achieved through the work of American inventors such as Nikola Tesla, but also in the scientific leaps made by German scientists who had realized anti-gravitic flight, which is classified today because it is based on a mechanism which would be disruptive to the current energy sector that is based on fossil fuel. I think that the cultural degradation in society since World War II, or more accurately since World War I, speaks for itself. But it is some of the lesser known spiritual and esoteric beliefs of the 19th and early 20th century that is the topic of today's episode. George Gurdjieff was a philosopher, mystic, spiritual teacher, and composer of Armenian and Greek descent, who was born in a part of the former Russian Empire that is now Armenia, and taught that most humans do not possess a unified consciousness and thus live their lives in a state of hypnotic waking sleep. This concept is mirrored in certain interpretations of the Bible or Old Testament, when humanity was said to have fallen from a higher state of consciousness, symbolically rendered in the story of Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden. Gurdjieff postulated that mankind could, however, achieve or regain its full potential, describing a method to do so, calling his discipline, quote, the system or the work, meaning to work on oneself. According to his principles and instructions, the most effective method for awakening one's consciousness unites three ancient methods utilized by Sufis, monks, and yogis, which is why he referred to it as the fourth way. Gurdjieff argued that many of the existing forms of religious and spiritual tradition on earth had lost their connection with their original meaning and vitality, and so could no longer serve humanity in the way that had been intended at their inception. As a result, humans were failing to realize the truths of ancient teachings and were instead becoming more and more like automatons, susceptible to external control. At best, the various surviving sects and schools could provide only one-sided development. Instead of developing body, mind, or emotion separately, this method attempted to work on all three to promote comprehensive and balanced inner development. Semen retention and transmutation of sex energy was paramount to his higher level teachings, as it is to all schools of alchemy, secret societies, original Buddhist and Taoist philosophies, all Aryan and mystery school religions, including mystic Christianity, and the Sufi, monk, and yogi masters that comprise the three ancient paths Gurdjieff expanded on. He believed in harnessing one's life force to produce what he called a, quote, finer energy to nourish higher spiritual development. Gurdjieff was of the opinion that sexual energy in the modern Western world was misused in the pursuit of personal pleasure and gratification. He claimed that, in general, the only two proper ways of expending sexual energy were through a conventional sex life or through spiritual transmutation. When his students inquired about the value of celibacy in the process of spiritual transformation to create a, quote, astral body, the alchemical transmutation of coarse matter into fine matter, Gurdjieff gave a very nuanced and informed answer. Quote, sexual abstinence is necessary for transmutation only in certain cases, that is, for certain types of people. For others, it is not at all necessary. And with yet others, it comes by itself when transmutation begins. I'll explain this more clearly. For certain types, a long and complete sexual abstinence is necessary for transmutation to begin. This means, in other words, that without a long and complete sexual abstinence, transmutation will not begin. But once it has begun, abstinence is no longer necessary. In other cases, that is, with other types, transmutation can begin in a normal sexual life, and on the contrary, can begin sooner and proceed better with a very great outward expenditure of sex energy. In the third case, the beginning of transmutation does not require abstinence, but having begun, transmutation takes the whole of sexual energy and puts an end to normal sexual life or the outward expenditure of sex energy.
Gurdjieff was a vigorous, charismatic man with a robust sexual nature, described by biographer James Webb as a sensual man who enjoyed the pleasures of the bed as much as those of the table. Gurdjieff's sexual conduct shocked many people in the 1920s and 1930s, especially in conservative America. There were rumors that he had a highly varied sex life and was involved in unusual sexual activities. Some claimed he was a master of exotic tantric sexual practices learned in the East. He clearly possessed a sophisticated and nuanced understanding of the role of sexuality in the process of spiritual transformation, and enunciated a complex model of the transmutation of sexual energy to a higher developmental level. At times he was celibate, at other periods highly sexually charged. His sexual life was strange in its unpredictability. At certain times he led a strict, almost ascetic life, having no relation with women at all. At other times, his sex life seemed to go wild, and it must be said that his unbridled periods were more frequent than the ascetic. At times, he had sexual relationships not only with almost any woman who happened to come within the sphere of his influence, but also with his own pupils. Right work on oneself, Gurdjieff taught, begins with the creation of a permanent center of gravity, a task which is supported by the correct use of sexual energy. The role of the sex center in creating a general equilibrium and a permanent center of gravity can be very big. Almost everyone who met Gurdjieff was struck by his powerful personality and commanding presence. Together, his physical attributes, personal magnetism, and immense knowledge created an impression of great strength and mastery. Gurdjieff possessed an enigmatic quality and a mystique that set him apart from other men. The widely held belief that he possessed hypnotic and psychic powers only deepened his aura of mystery. His alleged use of these abilities as part of his teaching, condemned in some traditional spiritual circles, has always been a source of controversy. Gurdjieff possessed an undeniable personal power and magnetism. The sheer force of his presence made a lasting impact on others. Student Henriette Lanz describes the impression Gurdjieff made at their first meeting. "I was struck by the impact of his force, very quiet, calm and controlled, yet almost frightening, but more than anything by the degree of his total presence, a presence which I felt extended to the tips of his fingers. It gave meaning to all his movements, which seemed so much more alive than ours. As alive as those of a cat or a tiger. I also felt very strongly his vast generosity, a generosity which I would call superhuman."
Of course, Gurdjieff also addressed non-carnal techniques for cultivating bio-electromagnetic energy, otherwise known as chi, ki, prana, or vril. For example, he noticed that the completion of small, voluntary tasks with focus gives one immense power, confidence, charisma, and magnetism. Quote, "To undertake voluntary aim and to achieve it gives magnetism and the ability to do. It is gained only through conscious labor and intentional suffering, through doing small things voluntarily. Make some small aim your God, and you will be going toward acquiring magnetism. Like electricity, magnetism can be concentrated and made to flow." Gurdjieff's teaching addressed the question of humanity's place in the universe and the importance of developing latent potentialities, regarded as our natural endowment as human beings, but rarely brought to fruition. He taught that higher levels of consciousness and higher bodies exist, how to increase and focus attention and energy in various ways, and also taught his pupils sacred dances or movements that they perform together as a group. Part of the function of these various methods was to undermine and undo the ingrained habit patterns of the mind and bring about moments of insight. Gurdjieff also emphasized self-observation in his students, and although he never used the term fourth way in his writings, after his death, his students published a book titled The Fourth Way, based on his work. That said, here's a short but entertaining excerpt from Alan Watts commenting on Gurdjieff and his sacred dance.
Could I hear any comments on you, any opinions about Gurdjieff? Gurdjieff.
Gurdjieff was a magnificent old rascal who lived a joyous life, and most of his disciples lived extremely restricted, rigid, and serious lives, because the object of Gurdjieff's method was to weed out those who understood from those who do not. And those who understood went away, and those who did not understand remained. Gurdjieff laid a trap for people who think that the purpose of life is power, that is to say, to control everything. And he beguiled them with the idea that they were all asleep and not fully in control of their own processes and their own organisms. And he assigned them the impossible task of being the Lord God Jehovah, each for oneself. He set them to doing this with great rigor, and he added to this the discipline of dances, in which you could exercise every limb working on a different rhythm to give yourself the illusion of this sort of omnipotence. But if you persevered in these exercises hard enough, you would discover that they were all nonsense, at which point you would have attained Mr. Gurdjieff's stage of illumination.
Thank you.
I decided to stop by at my favorite Thai restaurant on the west side called Thai Dishes on Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica. I'm told that some of you have also come by on my recommendation and that you tried the Po Tak seafood soup, which is always served hot and never disappoints. I followed it up with an order of Pad Khi Mao, which is flat noodles and shrimp, spicy and very delicious. I wanted to thank all of you for the support and hope everyone enjoyed this episode. I'll see you next time. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.